Eric Zorn is a columnist for the Once Upon a Time Chicago Tribune. You read him now once and again in the Daily Herald, and he is the publisher of something called the Picayune Sentinel. And we invite Eric to join us on Wednesdays to catch up on some of the things he's been writing about. Hey, Eric, how are you?
I'm good, John. Nice to talk to you.
Well, then, why do you work in Chicago?
What is this with you and the voices today? You're doing a whole morning zoo here.
Yeah, let's hope not. By the way, did you see, just speaking of Darren Bailey, though, that he has the idea that 90% of the students going into the University of Illinois, this is his new campaign message, he'd like to see 90% of students going to the U of I, the freshman class, by 2026 anyway, they would have to be Illinois residents. I think that will play up and down across the state, don't you?
Well, the thing about out-of-state residences, they pay much higher tuition and they really support the institution. And students that come in from out of the country pay full freight. They often don't get those little those scholarship offers. So if you were to try to limit the number of out-of-state students and foreign students coming into these institutions, and this includes not just U of I, but you know, Illinois Tech and you know all these schools in the state, you would find that they would have lots of funding problems. So I'm not sure this is a great idea. Other states take our students. We take other state students. I don't know who this is going to play to exactly, because the tuition is going to only have to go up to cover the cost.
I think Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin have a sort of reciprocity, and we don't in Illinois, that we pay out-of-state tuition when we go to those schools. But some states don't charge out-of-state tuition to neighboring states, and Illinois just seems like we get it coming and going. Don't you know kids who have done everything right? They got good grades. They were in band. They took honors classes. You know, they cured cancer in the summer with a lemonade stand. They did all of those things. And then they apply to the University of Illinois, our great state tax-supported local institution, and they don't get in because, what do you know, Maine South has a bunch of kids that are already getting into the U of I. And so they don't get into the U of I. And granted, then they go to Wisconsin or someplace else. They go to Illinois State. But I do think that the U of I should find a way to not penalize kids who are unfortunate enough to go from really good high schools in the Chicago area.
Well, yeah. I mean, but the thing is that you have to realize that even these state schools, they're businesses, and they've got bottom lines to meet. And they're not letting kids in from Montana because they want the perspective of big sky country people. They're letting kids in from Montana because the kids from Montana are paying more money. So they can have the amenities at the U of I. They can have the climbing wall and the nice student center and so on. So it is. I mean, the thing is, like, what we're digging into here is this whole issue of college costs, which dovetails with the discussion that we had on the Mincing Rascals last week, the podcast, and that people have been having all over the country, which is that we're forgiving these student loans, but we're remembering that the student loans are going toward paying these college costs, which is, as you pointed out, have more than tripled the rate of inflation over the last few decades. And that is really the problem we're talking about.
What are we talking about? On the Mincing Rascals, we pointed out that if the cost of college had gone up with inflation for the last 40 years, Northwestern's tuition today would be $16,000. And right now it's about $62,000.
Right. So maybe my math is a little off, but it's been a while since I've been in college. But yeah, so four times, right? I mean, it's pretty
three
grotesque
or four, yeah.
the way that these costs have gone up, and they've gone up because the demands of the students and the demands of the faculty and the programming and everything else. So I don't know that Darren Bailey's pitch here is going to. First of all, I don't know what kind of control a governor would have over admissions.
I was wondering that too. Maybe that's a good idea. Even if we said it's a good idea, I'm not sure that the governor can do that, but. I'll tell you what, at first blush, I thought, okay, that's a clever idea. That is a clever, smart, populist idea. You don't like it.
Well, No, well, I do like it. I like the idea that if we're going to be, as taxpayers, John, you and I are supporting these state institutions, and it does make sense for the majority of admissions, or even a lot, you know, the great majority of admissions to go to students in our state. That's definitely true. But I mean, I'm just sort of looking at the cold reality of what that would actually entail, which would either be a cut in academic programming, probably, or an increase in tuition and the state level tuition. What the current system allows is for state tuition to be probably lower than it really ought to be by market values, even though it's high.
Yeah.
It's higher. If you're in state, it's probably lower than it would be if they had this across the board admissions thing where you would have students just from Illinois. You'd have to raise the prices on.
Boy, oh boy, you do not know how to campaign, man. That is not how you care. That's not how you throw out a campaign promise. You say, I like this idea. It's going to be great for Illinois. And then all of those details that you're worried about, Eric, is not the sort of thing you dwell on the campaign trail. Come on.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll get behind it 1,000% then. How's that?
Now you're talking. There's two things that you wrote about in the latest issue of the Picayune Sentinel. Let's just spend a minute on one and then more time on the Maryland. Is it LEMAC story?
It's LEMAC, yes. LEMAC, yeah.
I know the story. It's been a long time since I've said that name. And what a tragic and fascinating story. An interview you had with her. We'll get to that in a minute. Give me your best 60 seconds on where you are about how problematic this business of drifting and drag racing is in the city.
All the stunt driving where the cars are taking over intersections and then the police show up to break it up. They throw firecrackers and rocks and bricks at the police. And, you know, as I pointed out in my issue today, it's kind of a minor crime in most respects so far. I mean, no one's been killed at these events. It's noisy. It's annoying. But I think that the symbolism behind it is very troubling, which is this. It is chaotic. The police have no way to control it. It's similar to the feelings that I have about all the catalytic converter thefts and all the carjackings that are going on, that it just feels like the police are outmatched. And I'm hoping the Sun-Times had a very nice editorial this morning saying, you know, we have to crack down. We have to, you know, they just passed a crackdown in the Chicago City Council with $10,000 fines if you get your car impounded. And they say that we should double that, that we need to have a special strike force, a task force, to make sure that this kind of thing gets under control. It's annoying to neighbors. It doesn't happen in my neighborhood, but it does happen in places that have a lot of residents in it. And I think that for the city to not take this seriously, which they do seem to be, I give them credit. The news conference yesterday and the statement of purpose that Superintendent Brown has made makes me confident that they are, or makes me hopeful that they're going to really crack down on this. Because when you let this kind of thing go, again, it's all about symbolism. And I've gone over my 60 seconds, but the reason that this doesn't take place in the Soldier Field parking lot sanctioned to the city, but on the streets, is this is a big middle finger to the police and to the residents of the city. And that's why people come out and watch it, because it's so transgressive.
11:43, you also wrote about Marilyn LeMack, who at the age of 44 was convicted of murdering her three children. This is a Naperville story from 2002. Picayune Sentinel publisher Eric Zorn, longtime columnist at the Tribune, he's in the Daily Herald once in a while, wrote about, all right, Eric, you pick it up from here.
I will pick this up, yeah, and I'll do that as much of a Reader's Digest version as I can. You may remember it was in March of 1999, this big, beautiful Victorian home in Naperville. Marilyn LeMack, who was an emergency room nurse, killed her three children and then tried to kill herself, and she was involved in an extremely messy divorce. And this made news all over the world. I mean, it was just a horrible story. No one could figure out, like, why. And the allegation was that she was trying to get back at her husband. Her marriage had fallen apart. And she had a trial, and she was really almost catatonic during the trial. I covered part of it. And she went into prison. She was sentenced to life without parole. She pleaded insanity. That didn't work. And she has given no interviews to Chicago area media until she agreed to talk to me about a week and a half ago. And she has filed a petition for executive clemency with Governor Pritzker. And the grounds on that are that she was in an addled state, scrambled thinking, because she was on very, very high doses of Zoloft, the antidepressant. And there are instances where high doses of these antidepressants have put people into manic states. It's rare that they commit violence against others, but it's more common that they become suicidal. In talking to Marilyn Lamack, she told me that her idea was that her husband had moved on from her and the children, and that she thought that she could make everybody happy by taking her own life and taking the lives of her three children. They were 7, 6, and 3. And it was obviously a horrible, horrible thought that she had. But she said, everybody's going to be happy. He's going to be happy, referring to her ex-husband. I'm going to be happy. The kids are going to be happy. Everybody's going to be happy. And she said, I know it sounds crazy. I know it. How can somebody think that? But that's where I was. And so that's her basis for her petition to be let out of prison after 23 years. My personal sense is that this is a question that probably should be really carefully looked at a trial, where you'd have experts talking about the effects of these drugs. And is it fair to say that she was intoxicated? She was involuntarily intoxicated, because there are some court decisions that support the idea that if you are involuntarily intoxicated and you commit a terrible crime, that you you're not excused necessarily, but that the offense is less than what she has. So this is the story, the question that people have been knocking around at the Picayune Sentinel. Had a lot of readers weigh in. A lot of people just say, well, you know, she's a monster. That was a monstrous act. It can never be forgiven. And other people say, well, yeah, you know, I've had experiences with these SSRI drugs and these antidepressants, and they put me into states that made me act in ways that I would never have acted before. And so she deserves some sort of compassion for this. Like I said, I spent about an hour on the phone with her. She's still in prison, obviously. And she sounds very normal, and she sounds remorseful, but still seeking the question that we all had when we heard about the facts of the story, which is why? Why would you kill your children? And how could you possibly do that? This was a woman who had no history of anger issues. She didn't even believe in spanking her children. And then to go from that to killing them by her own hand. I mean, she suffocated them with her own hands. Is one of the most baffling and troubling and sad and horrifying stories. Yeah. I think many of us who are in the area remember that story and at the time, and having that same question. What was going on with her?
And that she had what a lot of people would judge as a very comfortable life made her act seem that much more petty or self-indulgent. She said since then she's been a model prisoner, that she's been living with this and having to live with this for the last 20 years. And I just wanted to quote Joe Burkett, who was then the DuPage County State's Attorney, who said she never had a break from reality. He's now an Illinois appellate court judge, you write. She knew what she was doing. She had a full appreciation of her conduct. It was a combination of depression, revenge, and guilt over what she had done to her marriage, even before she killed her children. He's not backing down. He has no sympathy for and thinks, it sounds like, huh, Eric, that she should stay in jail.
Oh, yeah, he definitely thinks that. The state has filed a petition in response, and they say that they don't, first of all, I think they're not buying her claim of that she was intoxicated, involuntarily intoxicated by Zoloft. And they say that, you know, she has not paid enough of a price for what she has done. And their other claim is that this is not the kind of claim that deserves executive clemency. It perhaps deserves a new trial, which is, I mean, I think I would meet them there. I think, you know, I still have the why question, and I still wonder, is it really possible that even when you're on these awful drugs, or not awful drugs, these drugs save lives. Let me be clear. For some people, these drugs, these antidepressant drugs, have side effects that are pretty bad. But for most people, they bring them out of suicidal ideation, and they are helpful. So these are good drugs for the most part, but they do have some side effects. I think this is a question that needs to be carefully examined, because if you do have a situation where someone really was not in her, she was clearly out of her mind, right? I mean, the question is, was this because she was evil or because she was just, you know, really, really angry? and that put her in that state, or was it a combination of things? Burkett seems to suggest that it was a combination of depression and rage. I know that her ex-husband, who's a physician, I think he's now out of state, has no sympathy at all for her anymore, and you could understand why. She took three children from him, and that's, you know, I don't know how you ever even begin to get over that. She says that she's taken full responsibility for her part in the actions, but as the state says, the heavy price she has paid is incomparable to the opportunities that she took from her children to grow up, to have their own children and make a difference in the world, or the price paid by their father and other family members who are not able to see them grow up.
Yeah.
That's a hard, sharp reality. So this is one of those situations where it's not like this woman was like a psychopath like John Wayne Gacy or someone who was predatory all the time. She was a perfectly normal person for most of her life.
But I'm wondering where another trial would get us, Eric, because she's admitted doing it. The facts don't seem to change much, except maybe we have a little more sympathy to what certain drugs can cause certain people to do. Well, we're there right now. So I wonder what a new trial would do that we don't already know.
Well, a new trial would bring into play a 2006 Illinois Supreme Court decision that does allow for the involuntary intoxication with prescription drugs. There was a case where a man had taken Zoloft and had shot his wife and his wife's lover, and he was given a new trial based on that intoxication from Zoloft and alcohol and Excedrin PM or Tylenol PM, I think it was. So there was a court case between then and now, and a Supreme Court case that might change the way the law is interpreted. And I think we do know more now than we did 20 years ago about the effects of these drugs, and that needs to be, I think, examined. You know, like I say, my position is that I think this is something that should be taken seriously, and perhaps we can at least learn something about this, and more warnings can go out to physicians to monitor someone.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the things that's really sad about this is that she was not being carefully monitored by her physicians, by the prescribing people. They weren't keeping track of her, knowing what she was going through. And that's something that maybe we need to look at also. So maybe something, even if she stays in prison forever, this is something that we can use as a place to talk about this issue a little bit more. So,
Eric Zorn's the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, the weekly newsletter containing commentary and comedy and more. Search for the Picayune Sentinel online or just email ericzorn@gmail.com and he'll add you to the mailing list. Nice to talk to you, Eric. I'll see you in the next round of the Mincing Rascals on Wednesday.
I'll look forward to it, John. Thank you.
That's easy.